Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. For the remainder of the hour, we're joined in studio by world-renowned photographer Jerry Uhlsman. He comes to Southwest Florida for the opening of a retrospective exhibition of his work at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College here in Fort Myers. Uhlsman will deliver a lecture this evening to open the exhibition's reception. Uhlsman is known for the complex darkroom techniques he pioneered in the 50s and 60s to create his surrealist images. He was considered a leading figure in what was then the new field of pop photography in the 60s and is regarded as the pre-digital master of composite imagery and photo montage. With more than 75 original photographs, including some never-before-seen works, this will mark one of the largest retrospective exhibitions of Uhlsman's photography in recent years. He's a past recipient of the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship, and his work can be found in the permanent collections of major metropolitan museums all over the world. And outside of galleries, his work has been featured in other venues as well, including the opening credits of the television series The Outer Limits in the 90s, the illustrated edition of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, and most recently on the cover of Bon Jovi's 2016 album, This House Is Not For Sale. Jerry Uhlsman, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Also with us in studio is Rauschenberg Gallery Director of Exhibitions and Collections, Jade Dillinger. Great to speak with you again, Jade, as always.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure.
I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And I wanted to start at the beginning. I'd read that your interest in photography began around the age of 14 or so in Detroit. I was wondering if you recalled what initially attracted you to photography in the first place.
Well, initially, my father had photography as a hobby. And then once I got to high school, I found that by photographing events and other people, it gave me a basis on which I could interact. It had a real sort of heightened social quality for me in that awkward teenage years. And then at a certain point, I decided that I started working part-time at a portrait studio gallery, loading film holders. And then eventually I decided I want to study and learn more about photography. And after I graduated from high school, I went to Rochester Institute of Technology, basically to learn portraiture in a portrait program.
And your connections here in Florida run deep. You taught photography at the University of Florida beginning in the early 60s. And I was curious about, what you were teaching in the classroom at that time versus what you were developing in the darkroom on your own and whether you were able to bring those techniques into the classroom early on or if that would have been considered, too far out of bounds at that time.
Well, initially, the University of Florida was one of the few universities in the country that had photography within the art program. That was very unique at that time. There weren't galleries for photography back then. Very few museums were showing photography. And I was the only photographer for many years on an art faculty. Now, I taught the basic photography program technically, but I also at that time spent a lot of effort in making slides and materials of important things that were happening in photography that were not really very accessible. You've got to realize back in that time period, all these significant books on photography you could easily read over a weekend. But now photography is far more greatly, accepted. And I did, the interesting aspect of all this is back in the early 60s when I would go to New York and I'd visit photographer friends, they'd look at my work and they'd say, well, now this is interesting, but it's not photography. They had a different perception. The irony was on the art faculty that I worked with, when I showed them experimental things I was doing with, they instantly responded, oh, that's interesting. They weren't critical because it was just another system for making marks, on paper. It has other qualities to it. But they gave me enough of a support system. And then eventually my major breakthrough was in 1967, as a little 51 years ago now. John Sarkowski, who was director of photography at Museum of Modern Art, gave me a one-person show. And that opened all kinds of doors for me. But there has been a tradition of experimentation in photography, but it's rarely been talked about, or it's hard to find, you know, written articles about. But there's always been a few people challenging the limits of any medium. You know, and even in the art world, you know, sculpture years ago was marble and wood, you know, the whole reinvestigation of the means. And I began exploring that, just saying that the darkroom, in a sense, it was part of the process, because prior to that, you know, the basic concept was pre-visualization, that you pre-vision this image, and the main creative gesture is when you click the shutter. And because I was on an art faculty, I began to feel like that rest of the process still has options of things you can do. And actually, in 1967, I wrote a paper called Post-Visualization. And it was simply an appeal for photographers to allow for the same kind of in-process discovery that occurs in all other areas of art. I mean, rarely does a painter begin with a fully conceived canvas, or the sculptor, or the printmaker, or and there's an ongoing dialogue. And I just felt that that same sort of celebration of the process had visual options that were interesting to explore.
Did you come across a lot of pushback in, you know, trying to sort of open up those strictures in the art world? And I guess probably every, you know, artist who's trying something new experiences that to some degree.
Well, yeah, there was definite pushback. And, you know, the Museum of Art, they enjoy controversy when things like that happen. But I know there was a magazine called Camera in London that early on, and this had been in the mid-60s, ran a big article on my work, and they had people cancel subscriptions.
Oh, wow.
Because I knew the editor, you know, he couldn't believe that, but they were upset that this kind of photography was being promoted. You know.
Well, in a way, I guess that's kind of how you know you've made it,
too. Yeah, I guess so. All right, true.
Well, and just maybe we should take a step back for a moment for folks who aren't familiar. Can you explain a little bit about your darkroom techniques and how you're able to create these crazy-looking images that you are?
Well, initially, I mean, you respond – the camera gives you – the camera is essentially a license to explore. It gives you permission to interact with the world. And when I was a graduate student, I still was partly involved with the traditional preconceived idea that you had to find this completed image when you click the shutter. And I found that if I thought too much about it, out of what I was photographing, you know, I would not do it. I mean, God herself could appear. And I think, well, what does that mean, sort of thing? And then gradually I realized I liked some of these fragments, and maybe I could use them in another way. And once I got the freedom of realizing that there was additional potential, I found that, you know, I could photograph a rock or a tree. And sometimes that simple gesture is like saying, I love you, rock. And it may end there. It may end up being used again in another form, or it had other possibilities. But I have no trouble. I mean, I've photographed like these 10 rolls of film in the last month, photographing. And then later I look at what are called context sheets that show everything on the roll. It's sort of a visual diary of the things you've experienced. And I begin to explore where are the options, where could this go. And the difficulty in answering that question, the point at which the better images occur, it goes beyond your conscious level of understanding why it works. It's sort of a leap of faith to think, you know, like the Bon Jovi image for his album, that this tree is going to blend into this building, you know. But I've gotten, I guess, enough sort of self-trust or the ability to jump off the cliff that why not try these things, and then you try to evaluate. But at the time you're making it, you're really just trying to be authentic, to respond to feelings you have and see where these images, you know, lead you. I mean, I've talked to people that are writers that, you know, they'll say if they create characters, there's a point at which the character runs away from them, you know, and they have their own sensibility. And this is what happens to me now. And the tradition, just back up to the 19th century, in the 19th century, if there's any photograph that has clouds in it, that is a multiple exposure. They had to take two different plates because the material was highly blue sensitive. So if you photographed the landscape, the sky was always white. But then it made a second image with a different exposure, you could get the sky. So there's 19th century photographs, particularly from the west, in which you'll find the same clouds occurring. And most of my photographs where the sky's in have been photographed when I was at Longboat Key looking out over the flat horizon line there and the tremendous clouds that occur.
Wow, wow. And I know you personally have this extensive, archive of negatives. And I'm wondering if when you go into the dark room and sort of combine right. different images to create one work, do you tend to use negatives of photographs that you've shot from around the same time, or will you select things from, all different periods?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, the most recent ones are sort of like the foreground in your consciousness, but I have them totally mixed with things all over. And one of the phenomena that I have recently – well, I've known it for a while, but that I cherish is that I can be working on an image – and remember something that I took 20 years ago that might work into that. And partly I think that is something that won't happen with the whole cell phone photographs now, because people with a cell phone, they go boom, 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 and they've made 10 pictures of you. In my time period, even fairly recently, we used to have to figure out the exposure. We had to focus the camera. We had to have a tripod. So there's a way in which you're spending more time addressing that subject matter, and it does become part of your sort of implicit memory that's embedded within you. And when you can touch into that phenomena, I think it has great value.
Right. And of course, on the subject of technology, digital cameras, image editing software that exists today, sometimes it can almost seem like it was intended to facilitate emulation of what you've been doing.
Yeah.
And I understand even once back in the 90s, a representative from Adobe Photoshop actually approached you to create an image on their then new software.
Right.
How did that experience go?
Well, it was interesting because, obviously I didn't – I'm totally analog. So they send this person and they offered me – well, who cares at this point? They offered me like $10,000. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm a faculty member at the university. It's my main stable income. Sure, I'll do it. And then they told me I had to buy a certain amount of equipment, all this sort of stuff. And that ended up being $9,632. But then they sent a guy and stayed for a week and set it up. And I basically told him what to do. We'd scan this and then he would put it together on the computer. And, when it was over, I liked the image, but was literally made on the computer. I then went in the darkroom and made the same one because I couldn't. The learning curve for Photoshop was way, too steep for me to deal with. But it's not a competitive sport, and that whole technology thing has advanced so much today that the quality of the inkjet prints is truly amazing. It's just my process, the traditional darkroom process, has become part of my creative process. It is therapy for me to go into the darkroom, and I go in – I was in 4 days last week in the darkroom, so –
Wow. Jade, what made you want to bring this exhibition to Fort Myers now?
Well, of course, at the Rauschenberg Gallery, we're always thinking in the context or through the lens of Bob somehow. Bob had started out as a photographer, and always used photographic images. And we did, of course, show the 100-foot photograph. But Jerry's work I've been a huge fan of since high school in the 1980s. I even went to the University of Florida my freshman year because his presence loomed so large there. And it just felt like a wonderful moment. Things came together rather quickly, but also this opportunity and his generosity, made it all sort of feel right. And I'm excited for people to have the opportunity to really see the work in person.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we are going to have to leave it there for now for our live show. But I do have so many more questions I want to ask. So if you'll stick around, I'd love to keep speaking with you. And then folks can go online and hear our full conversation as well. For the time being, thank you so much for being here. And of course, we're speaking with photographer Jerry Uelsman and Bob Rauschenberg Gallery Director of Exhibitions and Collections, Jay Dillinger. Uelsman will deliver a lecture tonight at 6 o'clock to kick off the opening reception of a retrospective exhibition of his work at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery. That exhibit is going to run through March 24th. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, Rachel Iacovone, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Cinqui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.
There I am between, spin yourself another dream of what you are and what you seem. Sing, sing, everything comes and goes and comes again. Let it out and let it.